90.1 FM KPFT in Houston and online at kpft.org.
It's that unriffled beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch that signals 8 p.m. Thursday. Time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling, and it's only here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm your host, Hank Rubicek, and alongside a team saturated in talent, Greg Audell, Drs. Warren Holloman and Mary Edgerton, stand-in and stand-out guest hosts like Eric Heen, Christy Gorman and Harwood Taylor, and ace engineer Tatiana Gago, we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on astonishing journeys before returning us safely to the present. You know, like most of the city, Tatiana is stuck at home in this monstrous storm, and I hope that all of you are safe and sound and on dry land listening to us, because this is a great place to be. I want to thank Michael Woodson and Wally James, who were kind enough to hang out and help us tonight, and we're looking forward to it. You know, this program has long served as a supportive place for novice tellers to introduce their repertoire of stories and a site for seasoned storytellers to introduce both their current collections and new works of wit and wisdom to you, the best audience around. Now, the two-person lineup tonight will be a case in point with Gabe Hansen, an electrical engineer in training and storyteller and a darn good one, and veteran Lauren Neamy, storyteller incarnate and rock star in the field. Lauren, are you there?
Oh, yeah, I am.
Excellent. Good. I'm sure the weather is better there, if ever there was
one. Hot and muggy.
Hot and muggy. Yeah, well, we love it, but boy, I'll tell you, what a storm we've got going on here. Now, Lauren was in Houston in 2016, and on March 17th of that year, he graced our studio, but tonight, he's obviously on the phone for Minneapolis, but we're going to do something a little different tonight with these round of stories. We're going to talk about narrative types and a bit about crafting. Not much, because this isn't Storytelling 101, but just enough to encourage a few ideas about ways we think of narratives. Let's start with Gabe. You know, Gabe Hansen grew up in Washington State, and he's been in Houston 13 years. He commissions medium and high voltage service to plants for Dashiell Corporation in Deer Park. He's a UH graduate and found himself following his wife to a guild meeting and ending up liking it. Gabe, you know, in lay terms, tell us what you do for a living.
For example, a plant, chemical plant or oil and gas will commission a new project and they need electrical service brought in. An engineer will design it. My company will come in and make sure that the engineer designed what the customer asked for. And then somebody will build it, and my company will make sure that what was built was what they asked for.
Build it, and they will come. I love it. Okay. You know, people like me push buttons, so people like you are pretty impressive. I know your wife, Olga. She's a great teller, but you're also an awesome teller. You construct stories to be heard and read. I remember you telling us that at the meeting. How do you distinguish between the two? Stories to be read and stories to be told.
I don't know that I necessarily distinguish between them as two different things. I think something that's written can be read well. And when you want to tell something, you have to change the way you do it. So it changes your presentation.
Right. And we're going to talk about that in a little while, because I have some samples of things that just wouldn't work in written form, but somehow when you put voice to it, it's amazing. And when Lauren talks about revelations, we're going to get into that a little bit more. Now, your first story, Valentine's Day, is about real life. At least that's what you said, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Tell us your story.
I get in my pickup and head for home. Man, this was a long day. Almost done. I still have the drive. This Houston traffic sure makes it seem like a second job. We're supposed to stay awake and alert at 5 miles an hour down I-45. Time passes and I exit Shepherd, heading towards Tidwell, where I will turn west on my trek towards home. My mind ruminates a little as I drive. What day is it? It's Wednesday. Isn't this Valentine's Day? Oh, man, I haven't done anything. Don't I remember that flower shop near the house is going to stay open late? If I hurry a little bit, I think I'll make it on time. I push the pedal down just a touch while reaching over for the phone sitting on the other seat. I glance over. My eyes travel over the radio and the speedometer, and I look down briefly as I spin the phone, seeking the on button. Something in the corner of my eyes, and I look up with my eyes not really turning my head, and I jerk up, and my foot slams down, and my thigh muscles clench, and my knee locks. My arms straighten, and I slam into the back. The impact, and we merge, and we separate, and a body goes flying, and I slam into the seatbelt. I rest my head on the steering wheel a little bit. As I look in the side mirror, I can see the light is still red. I ran a red light. I raise my head a little and see the crunched hood of my truck. I've so totaled it. There's the motorcycle that I hit. And where? Oh, my stomach hurts. He's not moving. I gotta go out there. I'm gonna go to jail. Oh, there's a lady running over to him. She's kneeling. She's obviously talking to him. Is he alive? Oh, his head came up. Thank God. He's not moving, though. I struggle to unclasp the seatbelt. Kind of slamming my shoulder against the door, I manage to get it open. As I slide out, all kinds of muscles and bones creak and crack. I kind of stretch a little bit and then gingerly start walking over. There's the motorcycle. It's flattened. I hit that thing so hard. As I approach his body, I can see his foot lying sideways. Is that? Ah, that's a bone sticking out. There's blood all over his pant leg. Man, he flew far. The lady and the others gathered look up as I approach. I kind of stop as the wall of hostility hits me. I look at the bone sticking out of his pant leg and at his jacket. There's paint from my pickup on his jacket. I look into his helmet. I can see his face. He's looking at me. And what comes out of me is, I'm sorry. He looks at me, and I can tell he struggles a little bit, and the response is, yes, you are. His chest heaves, and his eyes go elsewhere. I return to my truck, following as a drama of ambulances and EMTs and lengthy police report and a ticket for running the red light. At one point, a car races in, and this tiny lady jumps out and rushes over to the officer. And then he's speaking, and she sees me, and her head comes down, and she starts rushing forward. And he grabs her arm, and he points in the direction of the receding ambulance, and she takes off and runs. Through this entire ordeal, like a song in the back of my head, the phrase keeps repeating itself. Happy, happy Valentine's Day.
Okay. Interesting story. A lot of it is very explicit, and then some is kind of poetic in a way. We have to guess,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, your approach is that it is extremely specific. You're letting us in on the deal. You're giving us a chance to experience what you're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you want to do.
Yes.
Now, why is it that you don't want us to imagine? Why is it that you want us to follow you directly? See what am I, in other words, why are you so explicit? Which is a great form. Just curious.
A wreck is a traumatic experience for everybody there. It's traumatic for the person that gets hit. It's traumatic for the person that does the hitting. It's traumatic for the people that gather around and want to see this thing. We're drawn to sensationalism, tragic sensationalism. But not everybody in that play is evil or intends harm.
Got it.
There's nothing in the thought process there that was, I'm going to go run somebody over.
Right. What inspired that story?
I was the motorcycle rider.
Wow. Okay. I knew you were one of them. Right.
That was last Valentine's Day.
Wow.
And folks would say, after telling it, what a jerk. Maybe he wasn't. Maybe he wasn't.
Right. Right. Lots of messages in that particular story. Lots of parables. What's one that you want us to remember?
Bad things happen. That someone else is involved does not mean that they are out to get me.
Some Valentine's Day many years ago, I thought about this, you know, this poem that I wrote, and it was, we follow each other to a place we've never been before and fell to the ground that was so easily a memory. Lips molded to an eternal kiss, our minds tucked peacefully into each other. We spoke truths. You admitted to having missed myself. We loved for the world and another day. And believe it or not, that also dealt with an accident. Just wanted to point that out, right? Very interesting. Very, very cool. Lauren, we're going to come to you, my friend. Lauren Neamy has been an innovative storyteller, creating, coaching, directing, performing, teaching, and writing about stories for audiences of all ages in urban and rural settings for some 40 years. An author and a poet, his new book, What Haunts Us, from Moonfire Publishing, is a collection of non-traditional ghost stories. Other publications include the poetry chapbook, Coyote Flies Coach, the award-winning The New Book of Plots on the Use of Oral and Written Narratives, and the critically acclaimed Inviting the Wolf In, Thinking About Difficult Stories, which he co-authored with Elizabeth Ellis, who has also been on the show. And that is on the value and necessity of stories that are hard to hear and even harder to tell. He is the 2016 recipient of the National Storytelling Network's Lifetime Achievement Award, and we're really happy to have him here. Lauren, you claim that you began as a child fibber, but decided that you were less interested in telling lies than in improving the truth. For God's sakes, give us an example of that.
All right. So suppose I could say the dog ate my homework.
Uh-huh.
And that's probably a fib. But what if I say instead that while I was doing my homework, because it was Talk Like a Pirate Day, I got caught up reading the encyclopedia about pirates, and I found out that they were often organized as democratic societies, which elected their captains and shared booty on an equal basis. That's
wow.
Improving the
yeah.
truth.
That, that's great. So that is an example of improving the truth. Right?
Exactly.
I love it. Okay, a little bit of amplification, which is a license for every storyteller. Now, in the new book of plots, you talk about revelation and reversal plots as instrumental in building stories. You illustrate how a revelation is the basis for a punchline, and I want to read that little joke in your book that I think you got from a workshop, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. And
from August Rubrecht.
Right.
If I'm not mistaken.
Right. University of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
A man and a woman are having a romantic candlelight dinner in a fancy restaurant. Suddenly, the man clutches his napkin and falls under the table. The waiter, seeing this happen, comes over to ask the woman if her husband is all right. And she replies, unfortunately, he is. He just came through the restaurant door. Okay, now I've heard variations of this, but this one's pretty good. This one's pretty good. But tell us, what ingredients are required to include in a revelation, to include a revelation in our stories?
The primary ingredient is misdirection.
Misdirection.
Misdirection. You have to have the listener or the reader think that X is the fact when it is not, or when it's not to be understood as it's presented.
Okay.
So a punchline changes how we understand the material that preceded it. My husband came through the door changes how we think about the relationship of the couple.
Gotcha.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Right? Absolutely.
And this is, this is especially true when we're dealing with not jokes, but other kinds of stories that have emotional arcs, when we want to get into the how of the story, or how the characters in the story, you were just talking about, how complexity is there, is present.
Right. Now, don't you make reference to the Sixth Sense as an example of this, or am I thinking about an example of something else?
As a movie, The Sixth Sense does yeah. represent a revelation,
right.
Story.
Right.
Although I got to say, if you are an astute observer, you figure it out long before we get at the end.
Right, absolutely. But I see dead people, so I figured that out so long ago. Now, your first story, David's Ghost, demonstrates a revelation, and it's a great prelude to Halloween as well. Tell us that story.
Okay, so I'm going to tell the long version of this story. Whether the car swerved into the truck or the truck swerved into the car, it made no difference. The resulting explosion, the resulting fire left everyone untouched, or everyone incapable, everyone dead. I wasn't aware of that, of course. Bill McCarthy and I were sitting in the Four Queens, a bar in downtown Winona, as we had wanted to for a number of days, a number of weeks now. Bill's girlfriend, Trish, worked at the bar, and being poor, we really couldn't afford the drink, but she would bring us a steady supply of the mismade drinks and the things that got sent back, the rusty nail that wasn't rusty enough or too rusty, the screwdriver that didn't go the right way. And so we would drink pretty much anything that arrived, and by the end of the evening, we were both pretty loaded. Trish would tuck us under her arms and walk us back home. They lived just a little beyond me, above Tulug and Rusco Plumbing, and they dropped me off, and I would go into my place, go up the stairs. And as I went up the stairs, I had that sensation you sometimes have as a young man, when you've had too much to drink, of it taking a very long time and things not quite the way they should be. I lay down on the bed. I didn't even bother to take my clothes off and watch the ceiling begin to spin to darkness. I woke up at some point, and it seemed to me there was someone standing at the foot of the bed. It seemed to me there was someone saying, the hours, the days, the months, what have you got to show for your time? But that didn't make any sense. So I got up and I walked down the hallway into the bathroom. I put some water on my face. When I looked up into the mirror, there was that figure behind me, still in shadow, and the voice again, the hours, the days, the months, what have you got to show for your time? And I was trying to place it. I was thinking, I know that voice. And it occurred to me that it was David Darst's voice. I mean, he was supposed to be coming to visit, but I couldn't imagine that he had already arrived. And as I turned to say, is that you, David? There was no one there. I shook my head and I went back to bed, took off my clothes, went to sleep. When I woke up in the morning, I woke up to the sound of the phone ringing. And when I answered the phone, the voice on the other end said to me that David Darst had been killed in an automobile accident that previous night. The hours, the days, the months, what have you to show for your time? When I was on my way to David's funeral, I remembered this little thing that Don Juan and Carlos Castaneda at one point were driving across the desert. And Carlos looks into the rearview mirror and sees there's a set of headlights coming up behind them. And it's surprising to him. They're coming up quite fast. And he turns to Don Juan and he says, "There's someone following us." And Don Juan calmly says, "It is death." And now Carlos is beginning to get nervous. That doesn't make any sense, but still he's pretty paranoid because the lights just keep coming faster and faster, closer and closer. And then he looks and he doesn't see them, and he feels a great wave of relief, and he says, "They're gone," to which Don Juan says, "Sometimes death drives without the headlights on."
Wow. That's a great closure. You know, you do a great job at giving us the impression how you're recalling that right now and taking us there. Gabe does that too. What makes this a non-traditional ghost story?
Well, one of the reasons it is a non-traditional ghost story is it doesn't have the classic sort of elements of fright. There's no, the apparition is more ambiguous. The message, the voice, is not designed to frighten, but is designed to, in a more classic, going back to a much older tradition, trying to give a piece of advice or a piece of wisdom.
Yeah. Does that make it more frightening in your judgment?
Well, on some level it does.
Yeah.
Because of the possibility that this could have actually happened.
Yeah.
In point of fact, it did actually happen,
right.
But that's beside the point.
Right.
The real fright for me in the story comes from that little coda at the end. You know, as soon as you start thinking about sometimes death drives without the headlights on, you can do it a job on yourself.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, it's that sense of plausibility. I know it's one of the reasons I used to love, Rod Serling from the Twilight Zone. He did that so well. I met him when I was in college. I went to Ohio State, and he went to Kenyon and Ohio State, and he was on campus showing films from the Twilight Zone. It was just a couple of years before he died. I was a senior taking a class with this poet by the name of Bob Canzoneri, and it was a prototypical little professorial office with a fireplace on the top floor of a building. And he came in one day and he said, "I don't feel like teaching today. I have somebody who's going to do it for me." And in walks Rod Serling, 5'6", gray suit, lucky strike. And I remember he sat there, and only about 8 of us in the class, and I said something, and I have no idea what I said. But he looked at me after taking a drag out of a cigarette, and he said, "That's a good insight." And, I have no idea what I said, but it was the greatest compliment of my life. That was great.
Okay.
That was
yeah.
great. Now, how is a reversal plot different from the revelation?
Well, in a revelation plot, something is withheld and then revealed at the end. And in the reversal plot, you're just moving straight through the narrative, but what happens is the meaning shifts. What was black at the start of the story becomes gray or white by the end. Who you think is the hero begin to arise by the end. You change how the audience feels as you move through the story, and you do it by just creating these little parallels, these little mirror images of moments where the change in characterization or the change in description shift the balance.
Yeah. Now, the rabbit illustrates what you mean. Tell us that story.
It was summer. Well, they were at summer camp, and they were waiting at the dock for other people to arrive so they could get in the boat and go out to the island. He said, "Come with me. Let's take a walk." And she was happy to do so. They walked down a little trail past the pines, so green and so succulent, so full of the sunlight falling through the trees, warm and inviting. They came to a clearing, clover everywhere, and they lay down and began to explore, kisses, first gentle and then more passionate. And as they got into it, as they began to become more enamored and enraptured with each other, all of a sudden, there was a snap, and out of the bushes on one side of the clearing came a rabbit. It came down, and its legs bunched, and it leapt up, straight over his back, and then down, and then across into the bushes on the other side, and it broke his concentration. He turned from the kiss to watch the rabbit disappear and thought to himself, Why would a rabbit do that? Yeah. And he got up from her and walked over to where the rabbit had come from. He parted the bushes, and he could not see anything or hear anything. There was no fox. There was nothing, no dog, nothing that he could. She called him back. She wanted to resume, but the kiss was not the same, and he shook it off and said, it's time to go, and they got up, and they went back towards the dock. She was smoking a cigarette and complaining about how she was getting fat. He wasn't really listening. He was, at least not to her, his head was turned, and he was trying to see if there was something moving through the woods near them. It seemed as though the shadows had lengthened, and he could smell the rot in the woods. When they got to the boat, the others were there, and she showed with a funny little gesture the rabbit and talked all about it, and everyone laughed and asked her to repeat it, and he said nothing. They all got in the boat, and he got in the boat as well. But even as he did, he glanced back towards the forest. And I'll tell you this, the darkness did not stay in the forest, but it crossed the water and entered into his life.
Wow. That is a beautiful, beautiful story. That's a beautiful story. And, you know, you never would have known by the title that it's a summer camp romance gone awry, right? And what inspired this story?
Well, you know, what I got to say about that story, the rabbit, it's actually a small segment of a much larger ghost story about when that relationship really goes badly, where he and she are sitting in a canoe and he's waiting for something to be revealed and he doesn't know what it is. And eventually she gets angry at him and jumps overboard and swims away. And he waits all night, and in the morning he discovers a body floating next to the canoe. So, you know, this little segment, the rabbit, is sort of both a foreshadowing of what's to come and a way of sort of contextualizing the whole larger relationship. And it was actually inspired by, I did work as an arts instructor at a summer camp one year, and there was an incident where one of the staff members did discover a body floating in the water.
Wow. Yeah. You know, I was going to say it's sort of it demonstrates the beauty of a fable where you personify the human experience, but this is an experience I'm not sure we want personified. But another great example of an interesting kind of a ghost story. These come from your new book, or I mean, you make reference to this in your new book about haunts.
Yeah, in my new book, What Haunts Us, I do include some, not these stories, but stories of this type, mm-hmm. and also stories that are a lot more, what I would say, philosophically disturbing.
Well, this is Hank Rubicek with Wally Jane stepping in for Tatiana, and you are enjoying So What's Your Story with guest storytellers Laura Nemi and Gabe Hansen on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. Gabe, you're always good at identifying some strong features in stories, so chime in on a couple of unique things that you've heard in these two stories told by Lauren.
First of all, thank you, Lauren, for those stories that were nice to hear.
Thanks.
The human condition, part of the human condition is our curiosity, and it interrupts and wrecks everything. The gentleman in the rabbit story had a purpose when him and the lady went to the little clearing, and his curiosity just changed everything about what happened to his life. And in a way, in the first ghost story... when you wake up and you see an apparition, what are you doing getting up to see what's going on? Mm-hmm. Just close your eyes and go back to sleep. But our curiosity has to poke us and make us do stuff.
See, I would have wanted to see it.
Yeah.
I would want to see it, but I'm not normal. You can't go by me, but, you know, I want to see it.
Yeah.
I want to see it. Interesting. Okay, you know, last year at this time in October, my wife and I went to Gettysburg, and, you know, it's a true story, and we even talked about it on the air that we took a picture of a ghost in the Jenny Wade House, which is the second most haunted place in the country, according to ghost hunters. And I loved looking at this picture. And I looked at it, and I was just mesmerized by it. My wife didn't believe it at first, but she's the one who actually noticed it. Apparitions are just fascinating. And I don't know if that's something to be proud of. I don't know. Whatever. But, you know, good or bad, H-Town is a hub for storytelling. Let's shift into that. Our proud sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, hosts a Story Swap the fourth Tuesday of the month from 7 to 8:30 at Temple Emmanuel at 1500 Sunset, directly across from Rice University. It's a great place to listen, to tell, and to talk about storytelling to a very supportive group of like-minded people. The next swap is September 24th. For more information about the monthly swaps and the Guild's events, go to www.houstonstorytellers.org. And also, be afraid. Be very afraid. Michael, did you come home? You know, Halloween. Bad imitation of Dr. Lewis. Okay. In any way, okay.
Good try.
All right. Michael? Is that... Okay. Skyline Screamers on Saturday, October 26th at 7 p.m. at Marmion Park at 18th and Heights Boulevard. We can't talk price on Pacifica Radio, but we can do it here because it's free. Read more about this annual Fear Fest on the Guild site. And while you're there, why don't you do a couple of more things? One, become a member, because you can conveniently do it online. And then stay on that page and click on Radio Program on the menu to enjoy hundreds of our shows since 2008. As a matter of fact, Lauren's is March 17th, 2016. So What's Your Story was the first storytelling scene in Houston, and it's the seed that helped grow our community. So please, enjoy our past programs and continue to tune in every week for live stories that connect us to each other. No radio? Hey, no problem, because you can catch us online anywhere on the globe at www.kpft.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Hell, we're every place. We're all over the place. And if you have any program ideas, questions about storytelling, suggestions for guest storytellers, or tell us why you'd be a great guest, drop us a note at story@kpft.org. And I promise we're getting back to you. If you want to take your storytelling interests to the next level, the Tejas Storytelling Association and the National Storytelling Network are waiting for you to become a member. Check them out online. And finally, our friends at The Moth hold their monthly swap on the second Tuesday of the month at Warehouse Live. The next one is October 8th, and the theme is spooky. It's a great place to listen to some cool stories. Another key announcement, I don't know if Greg is around here, but Greg Audell, another one of our hosts and a good friend of mine, is it's his birthday today. I'm not going to tell you how old he is, but let's just say that his bank sends them a free calendar 1 month at a time. I just thought I'd throw that in there. Reminds me of a quick story. I know you're all asking this, right? There was a 94-year-old man who goes to a priest for confession. And he says, "Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. It's been 30 years since I've confessed." And the priest says, "Well, what is it, my son? What do you want to confess?" And the 94-year-old man says, "I made love with four married women last week." And the priest asks, "Well, why are you telling me this?" And he says, "Hell, I'm telling everybody." Okay, Gabe, you have a story. I couldn't resist. Give me somebody's birthday, and I'll give you an old. He's so old that when he was in school, they didn't have history. Okay, Gabe, you have a story called "Married to a Sorceress." What was the seed for this one?
I wanted to write something a little lighter. And I've learned about myself that writing something that makes you actually laugh is tough. So
laughing is good. Now, is this about Olga, your beautiful wife, who's sitting here in the studio? Is this about her when you say married to a sorceress, or is this just a,
She's a sorceress of another type.
Okay. All right. That was a nice diplomatic way of extricating yourself from that question. All right. Let's hear it, my friend.
"Take a sip of this," my wife said. "Give me your impressions." "What's it supposed to do?" I say as I tilt my head back and drop the vial into my mouth. "Oh my, that wasn't a sip." She sighs. "It's a potion of clarity. I want you to describe its effects." I look about me at the clutter of glasses and vials and bubbling stuff and jars of weirdness and kind of shudder. I might not really want more clarity in here. I think I'll take a step outside. Suiting action to words, I open the steel door, step out onto our porch, and look out past the stone-lined walk that heads up over the hill and then, like a river delta, disappears into the grasslands beyond. Out in the distance, there's a curved line of the forest that marks the edge of our wilderness, our little hole. My lovely lady's work is dangerous in its creation. So the workshop is a little stoutly built stone set of rooms out here in the wilderness. Kind of wonder to myself, how am I supposed to know this stuff bubbling in my stomach is going to do its job? I see out of the corner of my eye a bit of a flicker. So I turn to look, and there in my little garden I mostly tend, there's a rabbit eating one of my celery stalks. I squint my eyes with evil intent, and the rabbit leaps into my eyes. It's like my eyes have burrowed into its hair. I realize that I don't really want to pet rabbits anymore or touch other wilderness animals, from the fleas and nits and, I don't know, a tick or something, and the sheen of rabbit juice on it. Rabbits are kind of nasty. I relax my eyes, but know the rabbit remains bear-sized in my eyeballs. And then I see a ripple of flesh underneath the hair of its butt. Ugh. Oh, my aching nose. Has anybody ever asked you, does a bear poop in the woods? I gotta tell you, you do not want to know. I rub my face, trying to rid the scent of rancid rabbit gas, and kind of turn back in front of me, looking in front out over the vista. Just then I feel a pressure of air against my cheek, and with that characteristic save thyself speed, I jerked and ducked back, and a 747 loud missile buzzed by my head and then turns at an impossible angle and heads back for me. Turning, I dove and twisted into the and turned to see what this weaponized wonder was that was coming at me. As I landed on my shoulder blades with a thunk, I could see the hyper-flapping wings of a mosquito, its proboscis waving at me menacingly like a lance from a knight on a psychotic horse. With my overexposed senses, I could easily discern its flight path. So I reared my hands up and slap. This caused my head to slam back into the porch as the shotgun-like sound burst in front of my ears. Dazed, I kind of stagger up, close my eyes, holding on to the post next to me. I take a slow, deep breath. I could feel fibers of something tickling my nostril hairs, and with a big gasp, I reared back, and a super bellow, I sneezed. My neck muscles spasming and releasing. Stars burst in my eyes at the sound and the pressure. Holding tightly to this post, I reached over towards the door. My fingers touch and sliding down the super rough steel as it's cutting my fingers. I kind of wince at the pain on my fingers. I reach the door and reach step in. I flinch at the slide and click of the latch behind me. "What's it like?" my wife yelled with the volume of a stadium speaker a foot in front of me. I groaned in a whisper, the sound of a hurricane in my skull. My hands covered my ears, my eyes squeezed shut. As I slipped to my knees, blackness enveloped me.
Nice, 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 nice. You know, your stories, well, your two stories tonight are raw episodes of what you've experienced. You let them unfold, right? And you want us to feel the same thing that you have. You're looking for total resonating, right?
Sure.
So how do you want us to feel after this story? How do you want us to feel?
Our lives today are all about media, about superheroes and the wonderfulness of it. Mm-hmm. But we're humans, and life has all this other stuff. What's it like? What makes it so that being something other than human is so fantastic?
Your education, training, your job are far from the shores of storytelling, and you do it well. What triggered your earliest interest in storytelling?
I have a grandparent that was mm-hmm. that would tell me stories.
Yeah.
Just listening to people tell stories, and I enjoy them, and why not?
That's how I got started. My grandmother told great stories. Everything she did was in story form. I understand that. What world do you enter when you're crafting a story? You're not entering the world of engineering.
Kind of related. I don't so much believe in writer's block. I think writer's block is people isolate themselves and then have nothing to give.
Hmm.
I think that life is part of what creates your stories. And so as far as entering, I'm already in it. This is my life. And things that are fantastical are an expression of our human something or other, imagination, or a way of looking at a reality that's hard to see, and we make up a reason for it.
Right.
So if anything, once a character has begun, I kind of have to let the character tell me what happens next, because the character drives.
Right. A lot of characters will be here next week also to tell some great stories, because we are going to be listening to stories called Too Cool for School with Dr. Mary Edgerton on So What's Your Story on 90.1 Pacifica, Fuel for Peace. And I think you're going to enjoy that too. Lauren, I have a question for you. In Minnesota, do they say ya, or is that more of a North Dakota thing?
Well, we say ya. We say all of those little cliche bits of language you can find people who say them.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, and I want to also know, I'm not sure you could respond to this, either one of you guys, but I want to know why there's both North and South Dakota. Are they that different? I just wanted to throw that out there. Just something to think about. Nobody has an answer for it.
Well, each would claim the other should be absorbed into it.
Yeah,
so.
I guess, but I'm just thinking, you know, the state of Dakota would be fine for me, but I mean, I'm just me. Lauren, you have an excerpt from Finding Gregory, and it's for our listeners. Tell us what Finding Gregory is, first of all.
So Finding Gregory is a new piece of work that I've just been developing. It actually is based in part on the last time I was in Houston, when I went to find, literally, a guy who I had worked with many years ago. And he was in an assisted living situation in Tomball, Texas. And
mm-hmm.
So the story is really about his life and about the search for him, and also about the grief that comes before death when you recognize that someone you know is suffering from dementia.
Okay. All right. Share that with us.
So here's a little bit from Finding Gregory is a big, long story. It's about 45 minutes, but here's a little tiny snippet from the middle.
Okay.
Because the equinox is coming next Monday, I'm using this particular piece. Gregory says to me on one afternoon as the equinox is upon us, "Come with me. There's something I want to show you." And we go out from the farmhouse, past the barn, past the cistern, out to the point where on one side the cow pasture slopes down to the bluff and the Mississippi River Valley beyond it. And on the other side of the little bit of road, the cornfield slopes down again to the edge of the bluff and down into West Burns Valley. He points towards the sun, which is just about to touch the horizon, and he says, 2 minutes, 45 seconds. From when it touches the horizon to the disc sinking beneath the horizon. Stand and we'll watch it. And we do. But as we're watching the sun set, he says to me, "The sun is fixed. It does not move. The earth is turning. Can you feel it turning? Can you feel that as the sun remains stationary and the horizon rises up, that we are falling backwards? Backwards towards night." And I have to admit that I had never felt it before, but I was feeling it now. 2 minutes, 45 seconds, and when the sun was no longer visible, that blush of red that becomes pink, that becomes purple, that becomes blue-gray, that becomes blue, that becomes the dark that is night, and the stars appearing first, those bright constellations and planets, and then everything else, until the entire firmament was filled with light and dark and impossibility. And Gregory says, it's good to be on a ball. It's good to know we are here spinning, spinning with joy.
Do you, you know, this is a more intriguing piece than I thought. You want to plug this a little bit more?
Well, I've been performing it at Open Eye Figure Theater here in Minneapolis.
Right.
And it's one of the kinds of performance pieces I'm offering to various people over the next couple of years. So,
yeah.
Because I think there's, for a whole bunch of us, how do you deal with grief and how do you deal with Alzheimer's and dementia is becoming more and more of an issue. And I'm interested in that moment where you suddenly realize that you are someone's memory.
Yeah. Well, what motivated this piece, Lauren? Why such a dedication of this piece? I know that
well,
might be.
Well, in part because I was, struck literally by the, you know, as Gabe says, the experience of living it.
Mm-hmm.
And in part because Gregory Hansis, who the piece is about, is an extraordinary man. I mean, he physically he looks like Santa Claus, and he actually was Santa Claus at a number of malls over the years.
Mm-hmm.
White beard, white hair, blue twinkling eyes, ruddy red cheeks, a bit, little pot belly, and a laugh, you know, that comes from such a deep place of joy. I don't know if he's alive or dead. The last time I left after seeing him, I left my phone number and told them to call me when he passed.
Mm-hmm.
And they haven't called yet, so I don't know. He may still be with us.
That's such a crystallized image of his persona. That's really amazing. The older I get, you know, the more concerned, I guess, is just a natural evolution of life. But just thinking more about grief and about Alzheimer's and about forgetting and about memory lapses and just a whole plethora of things that are interrelated. It's a very poignant story. Very, very poignant.
Right.
Yeah.
And I want to honor his life.
Yeah.
I know.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's really,
sure.
That's, you know, so those are the two things that are in balance inside that performance.
Mm-hmm. Gabe?
That story reminds me of my grandfather was an avid fisherman out in Northwest Washington. He hated eating fish. I asked him one time, sitting out on the Straits of Juan de Fuca, why do you fish? You don't like eating it. And he looked around at 6 a.m, 3 boats out, clear, nothing happening. Where else would you want to be on a Saturday morning?
Yeah, there you go. Interesting. Interesting. Lauren, you know, you declare that it's been said that you live your life with immediacy, poetic imagery, and insight. That's pretty philosophical. Give us a quick anecdote. Yeah, give us a quick anecdote taken from your life that explains that. Gabe did a great job at offering an anecdote that explains his grandfather's life. So, yeah.
Right. So recently I was up in Duluth, Minnesota. I was having breakfast on a Sunday morning at a place called Uncle Louie's. And there was a guy who was clearing dishes there. He must have been about 6'3", 6'4", about 300 pounds. Just a nasty-looking guy, unhappy-looking, wearing entirely black, taking plates off of tables. And he came to the table I was at, and he looked at me with my sort of military-style haircut, and he goes, "Been a long time since I've seen a Gordon Lilly, Glitty haircut." And I said, "Yeah, it has been, but, you know, some of us remember the old ways."
Right. Very, very good. Very, very good.
I mean, that's just a little moment, but that gave me such pleasure that, you know, I will work it into a story, or I'll work it into a poem, or I'll, mm-hmm. you know, Because it's like, yeah, when was the last time someone asked about Gordon Liddy?
Right, right. You know, a topic for many, and I had alluded to it earlier, and I just wanted to dabble in this a little bit, is written versus spoken storytelling. I have my own philosophy about this, and, you know, I tell people all the time that if you write something, you can give it to me, and I, even if it's poorly written, I can eventually get a sense of what you're talking about. But if you say something, you can only say it once. You really can. It's very meticulous. It's got to be intricate. It has to be sequenced. It has to really make sense. But that's just me. That's just my take. We know that there are a lot of differences. But here's a question that I wanted to ask. I wanted to ask you, Lauren. How do you convert a story made to be read into a story that can be spoken?
The first thing is you have to figure out what your breath is and what the story requires in terms of breath.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. Because it's spoken, it is entirely built around, you know, how you breathe. And in the written words, it's built around a different principle. It's written around what the eye can take in. So you have to make that conversion.
Yeah. Tell us what you mean by breath a little bit more.
Quite literally, each of us has an in and out for, you know, air entering our lungs and expelled from our body. And that will determine our both speaking style and our capacity in terms of how long we are willing to go with a phrase or with a sentence or with a thought.
Very good. Gabe, I know I asked you this before and you were saying there isn't much of a difference, and that's cool. But what do you think makes the story oral friendly?
If he had not said it again, I would have repeated what he wrote in his book of oaths, book of plots. You have to breathe.
Yeah.
Your breath makes such a big difference. And
you know, you have to be impressed over the fact that we both read your book. I mean, you know,
I am. I'm
you have 100%.
Yeah, thank you.
You have 100% of these people reading your books, for God's sakes. Okay, it's only two people, but nevertheless, statistically, that's a significant.
And
that's
the
right.
If I were to add on to that, it would be to slow down. We read at lightning speed compared to speech.
And that's a great point, because speech and listening are entirely different. Speech is always, always going to be faster. And whenever you say something, we can't process it until a moment later anyway. So that's a great, great point. Absolutely. You know, for me, sometimes I read things or I hear things in a movie that I think to myself, how boring that would be on paper. But it's fascinating when it's spoken. I have an example here. It's from the film Indecent Proposal with Robert Redford. I don't know if you guys saw the movie, but this is one thing that he says in the film. And for an experiment, I wrote this out. I wrote out the exact words. I gave it to my students, my storytelling students, and I asked them, what do you think of this story? And about 17 out of the 20 said, this is a boring story. I don't want to hear this. And then I read it to them. I'm not Robert Redford, but I read it to them in an expressive way. And most said, wow, that's a really good story. So he says, I was on the subway and there was a girl. And she was dressed like, oh, I don't know, she was just gorgeous. She was the most beautiful woman I've ever seen. But I was shy. And when she looked at me, I look away. When I looked at her, she looked away. When it was time for me to get off the train, I did. I looked back, and she gave me the most beautiful smile I ever saw. I wanted to go back and meet her and just open the doors and give her a hug. And I went back to the station, same time, for 2 weeks. She never showed up. And I never want that to happen again. Now, this is about as simple a series of words can become. You know what I'm saying? Really, really, really simple. But somehow, I don't know, it just worked. This is another example of a story that, and this is sort of interesting. A student said to me, you know, this is really a boring story, but I'm going to share it with you. All right. That's what he says. And he says, you know, I lived in an efficiency in a Victorian house in Boston, and I received a knock at the door one morning, and it was a woman who asked me for a cup of flour. I told her, my place is a mess, and besides, I don't cook, so I don't have any flour. And then, the next day, she came by, she knocked on the door, and she asked for a cup of sugar. And I said, lady, I told you yesterday I don't have any flour because I don't cook. I don't have any sugar either. She left, The third day, she came and she asked for a cup of salt. And I got a little pissed off, and I said, "Lady, I told you I don't have any flour, I don't have any sugar, I don't have any salt. Please, just leave me alone." And she left. The next day, I was coming home, and I saw a handyman on top of the house replacing a window. And I asked him what he was doing, and he said, "Well, I'm putting back this busted window from this above apartment, from this third floor, because a woman just lost it, and she jumped out of it. It was that woman who kept asking for the flour and the sugar and the salt. She just needed a friend." And I thought that was the most poignant story. Now, on paper, you have a bunch of words without anything that even smacks of prosaic imagery, mm-hmm. right? You have to do something with it. And I just thought, I don't know, I just thought that was beautiful. And to me, that's an example of something that may not work as comfortably on paper as it does verbally, in any event. Lauren, who was the storyteller in your home growing up?
Actually, my Uncle Johnny. In our house, you know, my father was a reticent sin, so he didn't tell any stories, and my mother really didn't tell stories. But my Uncle Johnny, he had lots of stories.
Very good. And you, Gabe, your grandmother, grandfather?
Kind of my dad's father,
dad's
my grandfather.
Father. Okay.
He used to tell me when we would come over, I talked to your teacher. I noticed you've been kicked out of school. You don't have to bother going back anymore. And other such embellishments. What'd you call it? Improvements of the truth.
There you go.
Yeah.
Embellishments. Yeah, I love that. Yeah, I'm going to remember that one. I love that one. Yeah. Well, you know, I can't believe we're just about out of time, but Lauren, I can't thank you enough for being on. I'm sure you have more important things to do for the last hour, but you were a pleasure.
And oh,
it's
I
always,
enjoyed being
it's
here.
Just, it's always,
and I
it's
was
always
happy
great.
To hear Gabe's stories.
Yeah, and I just love having you two guys on. It's miserable out there, and this was a great, great night. Thank you, Gabe Hansen, for introducing your storytelling prowess to our KPFT listeners. You won't find a better, more appreciative audience. And thank you, Lauren Nimi, for being a good sport by hanging around, pretending you had nothing better to do, the way that you effortlessly transform your listeners into astonishing story worlds is always too good to pass up. Don't you dare move, because Lars and the Tennyson Tape Deck is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turn it in for the night or just chilling. Join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. You keep loving a great story, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. This is Dr. Hank and Wally James and Michael Woodson, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it is never too late to live happily ever after.
If you decided to donate your birthday to KPFT this year, thank you. If your special day hasn't yet arrived, consider donating your birthday to KPFT. Here's how it works. Facebook sends you a prompt before your birthday asking if you'd like to donate your birthday to a nonprofit. Select KPFT as your organization of choice. Then add a personalized message so that your friends know how much KPFT means to you. On your birthday, they'll receive a Facebook notification asking them to make a donation in your honor to KPFT. Thanks again for supporting 90.1 FM KPFT Houston, Pacifica Radio for Peace.
The 2019 local station board elections are underway. If you donated a minimum of $25 or volunteered 3 hours between July 1st, 2018 and June 30th, 2019, you should have received either an email ballot, a postcard, or paper ballot. If you haven't, then fill out a ballot request form on elections.pacifica.org. Members without access to the internet can leave a voicemail for the election supervisor at 510-854-9663. Paper ballot replacements will be issued through October 7th. All ballots must be received by October 15th, 11:59 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to be counted. It's 90.1 FM KPFT in Houston and online at kpft.org.
Well, welcome to KPFT. Welcome to Tennyson Tape Deck. I'm Lars for the night. I won the contest. And